It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. The deadlock in Congress continues as Democrats and Republicans have yet to come to an agreement on extending government funding on a short-term basis.
We're checking in with Wisconsin's congressional delegation about the government shutdown. And we heard from Democratic U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin on the show yesterday.
Now we check in with the Republican-controlled House, where last month the GOP short-term spending plan passed by a vote of 217 to 212. In the Senate, that bill fell short of the 60 votes needed to break a filibuster and pass the legislation.
U.S. Representative Glenn Grothman joins us now for an update. Represents Wisconsin's 6th Congressional District. Representative Grothman, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Glad to be on the show talking to the erudite listeners of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Well, give us an update from the Hill. What is the status of bills being debated? What is being voted on today?
Well, the Senate is going to, one more time, try to get the 60 votes that are necessary to keep the government open. We have been told to return to Washington by Monday, which means our leadership team wants us working on some sort of deal or are hopeful that we will wrap up this shutdown by Monday. I don't know why the Democrats would want to continue it. You know, they voted in the past 13 times for similar resolutions. You know, it's not that difficult. You're just kind of marching in place, keeping the government spending and what the spending has been at past levels while we work out the final appropriation bills. And that's something that's been going on forever. You know, usually they wind up passing these appropriation bills a little bit before Christmas, but we always pass continuing resolutions. This time around, we believe, due to internal politicking within the Democrat Party, Chuck Schumer, who's the head of the Democrats in the Senate, he is afraid of a primary from AOC, afraid of a primary from the radical Democrats. And as the result, he does not want to continue down the path of keeping the government open while he negotiates. It's really unfortunate.
Well, here's the thing, though. Insurers are sending out letters on their, you know, on out-of-pocket premium hikes. Open enrollment is less than a month away. Are Republicans really that nimble to figure this out before the end of the year? These subsidies?
Oh, sure. Sure. Absolutely. Like I said, I think a normal time, it seems to me more often than not, the final negotiations are wrapped up in December before we pass what we call the appropriation bills. I mean, it's been going on forever. The idea that while we talk at the table, we have to shut down the government is just not true. They're two totally unrelated issues, right?
Well, I mean, healthcare policy, though, is at the heart of this fight, and Democrats in the Senate refused to vote for this Republican short-term funding bill that did not include an extension of the enhanced premium tax credits. So in Wisconsin, more than 313,000 people would be affected if the credits expire. Should Senate Republicans compromise here and negotiate a temporary extension for the healthcare subsidies now?
I'm sure they're negotiating, and like I said, in the past, when we do our appropriation bills, it is not unusual for the two parties to negotiate at the end of the year, negotiate all September, negotiate all October, negotiate all October, negotiate all November. That's just not unusual. I don't know why this time we have to settle everything. And by the way, the Democrats want more than just that. You know, they're talking about over $1 trillion in spending. You got to remember right now, we are borrowing 26% of our budget. So, you know, we just can't cave in to all the demands the Democrats have. We can do those negotiations as well, but while we're doing the negotiations, which may wrap up in a week, they may wrap up in a month, they may wrap up in 2 months, while we're doing those negotiations, there's no reason to shut down the government. Other than that, their leader happens to be from New York State, and he happens to be worried about a primary challenge, and he doesn't want to appear like he's getting along with Donald Trump. He wants to appear like a fighter.
Well, if these were negotiated separately, would you be open to extending those ACA subsidies?
Well, I think they're going to, like I said, I think they're going to wind up with some sort of compromise, but that's really not what the shutdown is over. The shutdown is over like I said, I think the Democratic leadership does not want to appear getting along with Donald Trump.
Well, let's
they
talk
want to
about
appear
negotiation.
As extreme as they can.
Let's talk about right. negotiation. We spoke with U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin earlier this week. Let's listen to what she had to say about negotiations in the Senate.
Right now, Senator Thune has insisted on pressing forward with a resolution that had no Democratic input.
No Democratic input. Should, Senate Republicans expect a bipartisan resolution to the shutdown if both parties aren't hashing out a bill together?
Well, when she says no Democrat input, there's usually not a lot of input in these things because what they're called is clean CRs. We keep spending at the same levels we did last year. That is par for the course. It's what's been done the last, 10 or 12 continuing resolutions. So it's not like this is a hardcore Republican document. We are just spending the same amount we were last year. It's not like we're trying to do a conservative poison pill in here or something. We routinely negotiate our appropriation bills throughout October, throughout November. And like I said, more often than not, sometimes we get them earlier than that, but more often than not, we wind up voting for them in December when negotiations wrap up. There's no reason to shut down the government while we're at the negotiating table. Other than that, Tammy's leader, Chuck Schumer, is afraid of appearing to get along with Donald Trump or negotiate with Donald Trump. And he feels to get kind of the radical votes out of the city of New York, he can't do that, which is unfortunate. If he can't do it, he should step down and let a more moderate Democrat or a Democrat not so beholden to the most extreme voters in New York City be the leader.
We're talking with Wisconsin's U.S. Representative Glenn Grothman about the government shutdown as we check in with Wisconsin's congressional delegation. The White House is warning of mass layoffs. As you know, federal workers, as a result of the shutdown, in the thousands, we've heard President Trump signaling this is a tactic to punish Democrats. Here in Wisconsin, there are about 18,000 civilian federal workers. Are permanent layoffs an appropriate response to the shutdown?
We have too many people working in the government right now. DOGE exposed the let's say in the Department of Defense itself, we have over 700,000 employees who are not uniformed. Okay, people sitting in cubicles on a computer. There is a lot of anecdotal evidence out there that these people aren't working that hard. So I think whether or not there's a shutdown is irrelevant. We should not be hiring people who are unnecessary. We are borrowing 26% of our budget. I don't know why people are not talking about that more, both when you talk about the subsidies and you talk about the huge volume of government employees.
So it sounds like this would be a way to decrease the federal workforce in the midst of this shutdown.
Correct. It would be. And like I said, it should have been done before anyway. We passed a military authorization bill before we left a couple weeks ago. And in that bill, they were anticipating like 35,000 less federal employees in the Department of Defense. But I'm convinced from what we found out in DOGE, plus from anecdotal evidence, people talk to people in their apartment building or their relatives or people from their church or whatever. And a lot of these people are not working very hard at all. I mean, to keep hiring people, many with over six-figure salaries, when they aren't working that hard, that's just irresponsible. And like I said, when you're borrowing 26% of your budget, so I would certainly hope that President Trump would step up and, let go. Certainly in the Department of Defense, but probably other departments as well, find 100,000 or 200,000 jobs that are not necessary.
100,000 or 200,000 jobs for, as you say, that aren't necessary that you would like to see laid off now here in this shutdown?
I'd like to see laid off whether there's a shutdown or not. I think the Big Beautiful Bill was a disappointment. because we didn't reduce spending like we have to for future generations. And I think the new authorization bill for the Department of Defense was a disappointment. And everybody up there who's honest, who, you know, gets out from the Capitol and talks to people, knows that there are a lot of federal employees, particularly in the District of Columbia area, that just aren't working that hard.
Well, let's talk about the economy. The 2018-2019 shutdown that lasted 35 days, the Congressional Budget Office estimated that shutdown reduced economic output by about $11 billion, including $3 billion that it never regained. You serve on the House Budget Committee. Are you concerned about how the shutdown could impact our economy?
Yes, but maybe it will bring attention to people working who aren't necessary. And like I said, we passed a bill. We want to do what's been done since time immemorial. Keep the government funded while we negotiate next year's appropriation bill. So we've done what the Democrats have agreed with forever. It's up to them whether or not they want to shut down the government for what I can see, no reason in particular.
Very quickly, Representative Grothman, you know, shutdowns damage people's lives, especially here in Wisconsin. What will you do to help repair the lives and make Wisconsinites whole who have been affected by the shutdown?
Well, I don't think it's going to be as big an impact as people say, right? All the big federal programs, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, they all continue on as before. There are people who are going to get a delayed paycheck, but they're still going to get their paycheck. Actually, and something that seems a little ridiculous, I felt, they changed the rule a couple of years ago where if you are not working, say you don't work for a month, you get paid for that month anyway. So, and then you might wind up getting overtime in the future. So there are a lot of federal employees who are even going to come out, I think, ahead of the game.
Representative Grothman, thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me on National Public Radio.
U.S. Representative Glenn Grothman, a Republican who serves Wisconsin's 6th Congressional District. Yesterday, we heard from Democratic U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin on the shutdown.
Coming up, a project on Lake Winnebago aims to restore wild rice beds that were once native, but federal funding was cut. We'll get an update from the project's founders.
Wild rice is a very important food. It's one of the first foods that our relatives depended on.
That's coming up next here on WPR News.
This is Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Wisconsin needs more affordable housing, and manufactured or mobile homes can help provide it. But advocates say the state needs to better protect thousands of people who already live in them.
As Addie Costello reports, the regulation of manufactured home parks is divided between Wisconsin agencies, and enforcement is limited.
Cindy Philby walks on the gravel road next to her home in Woodland Park. A patch of tall grass, garbage cans, and trucks line the edge of the Fond du Lac community. Philby stops at a pothole.
As you can see, the roads ain't exactly the greatest.
On the opposite side of the park, weeds poke through a web of cracked concrete. Philby has seen social media posts calling the park an eyesore and saying it should be paved over. She and her neighbors have filed complaints with Wisconsin's Consumer Protection Agency. One complaint detailed issues with the roads, garbage, and flooding. Another resident describes parts of the park after it rains as a lake. Philby says it's a mud puddle.
The water just builds. And in wintertime, it's fun, too.
The park is owned by Core Communities. It's a Florida-based company that owns parks across the country. Core declined to respond on the record for this story, but Woodlands Management did provide the state evidence that they were addressing issues last year. But residents say not enough has changed, including Philby. She moved to Woodland last year after she had to sell her traditional home.
I couldn't afford to get another house. So my next best thing to keep a roof over my head was a trailer.
She used everything she had to buy an older manufactured home for $4,500. She slept in a homeless shelter until it arrived from Iowa. Unlike other homeowners, she has to pay a monthly rent on the land her home sits on. She also can't move as easily as other renters. Moving her home again would cost more than it's worth. At the start of this year, CORE raised her rent by $75 a month. That's a tough increase for Philby, who relies on fixed disability payments.
They are squeezing everybody in this park to death.
She complained to the state after management offered her only a month-to-month lease. Wisconsin law requires all landlords provide year-long leases that provide better protections from rent hikes and eviction. But CORE never responded to the state's emails about providing a year lease, and Philby's complaint was left unresolved.
I was just constantly told to get an attorney. There's nobody in this territory park that can afford an attorney.
She wants more protection for communities like hers. State Representative Scott Krug says he does too.
People think if it's out of sight, it's out of mind, and they don't think that this is actually part of solving the overall affordability crisis.
He's sponsoring legislation that would create new requirements for residents and landlords and clarify certain existing laws for manufactured home park residents. Current regulations are confusing, and the responsibility for enforcing them is split between agencies. Steve Carlson says that leaves residents unsure about how to get help. He is the co-founder of the Wisconsin Manufactured Homeowners Alliance. The group organizes park residents to address problems and preserve affordability.
It's not clear how many people have any idea of where they would make a complaint if they had one.
Woodland residents complain to the State Consumer Protection Agency, but it's the Department of Safety and Professional Services that oversees things like park roads, drainage, and maintenance. The agency found inspection records for fewer than 20 parks between 2022 and the start of this year, despite listing over 700 communities in its licensing data. Wisconsin does not require any routine inspections, but Carlson points out that Michigan inspects parks annually.
It's an obvious problem with a very easy fix.
The state does not have records of Woodland Park's last inspection, and it isn't listed in state licensing data. Around 30% of communities that do show up on the state licensure's website have expired permits. A department spokesperson says they are working to get more parks renewed after switching to a faster online platform, and upcoming website updates will make it easier for visitors to navigate and file complaints. But for now, Philby says,
they can just do whatever they want, and the federal government's allowing them to do it. The town's allowing them to do it. The state's allowing them to do it.
That leaves her wondering if she'd be better off moving to an apartment. Addie Costello, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This piece was produced in partnership with the nonprofit Wisconsin Watch. This is Wisconsin Today.
A project on Lake Winnebago is aiming to restore wild rice beds that used to be native to the lake.
The Intertribal Lake Winnebago Wild Rice Revitalization Project brought together researchers and members of Brothertown Indian Nation to combine mainstream science with wild rice practices from the Brothertown tribe.
But earlier this year, the Environmental Protection Agency pulled millions of dollars that had been committed to the project, cutting into those efforts to bring wild rice back to Lake Winnebago.
Jesse Conaway joins us. He's co-founder of the Intertribal Lake Winnebago Wild Rice Revitalization Project. And Jessica Skisek is vice chair of the Brothertown Indian Nation and another co-founder on the project. I talked to them recently to learn more. Jessica, you're restoring wild rice in Lake Winnebago, Wisconsin's biggest inland lake. Why focus these efforts on Lake Winnebago?
It was really important to us to start our efforts on the Lake Winnebago watershed with our focus on Winnebago, because that's where our people were forced to relocate. We were originally from the eastern shores of the United States, and we were forced by the federal government to move a number of times. And when we came to what is now called Wisconsin, we came together with the Oneida and with the Stockbridge-Munsee Band of Mohicans and the Brothertown Indian Nation. And this is the area that our people settled on. And so we really wanted to start with Lake Winnebago and focus our efforts on what's happened to the wild rice in this watershed.
And let's stay with you, Jessica. There's an ecological importance. We'll get to that. But tell us a little bit, please, about the cultural importance to the Brothertown Indian Nation of wild rice.
Wild rice is a very important food. It's one of the first foods, and we know that that is a food item along with the Three Sisters and some other really critical medicines and foods that our relatives depended on when out on the eastern shores of the United States. There's more and more evidence that the wild rice was plentiful in those regions. Because of what was happening with the forced relocation of American Indian tribes from that area further west, some of that rice was no longer healthy. And so some of the rice has been depleted in that area. But it is an important foodstuff from a nutritional value perspective, but also from a very important cultural perspective for many tribes, including Brothertown Indian Nation.
Jesse, as I understand it, both of you recently got back from seeding wild rice in Lake Winnebago. First of all, for people who haven't done this before, what does that mean? What are you doing when you seed wild rice in the lake?
Yes, Rob, we are in, so 2025 is our third year of seeding wild rice in the tributaries of Poahekane, which is a Menominee language for the lake at the top of the Lake Winnebago chain of lakes. So Poahekane is, in English, that would be Lake Poigan. This is where the Wolf River, Mawesipe in Menominee language, empties into the system, into the watershed that becomes the chain of lakes. We pulled together a broad network of conservation and watershed citizen partners, and then convened knowledge, convened data, convened information on where Myome, where wild rice was and is surviving and persisting within the watershed that's gone through drastic changes over the last 100 years. We were awarded funding. Brothertown was awarded funding from NRDA for reseeding. And so we identified these two tributaries with help from project partners as places that would be good to seed. And so we're very excited because, as I said, we just closed out our three-year seeding commitment and cycle to steward these rice beds and boost the historic populations by adding seed in.
Jessica, before we move on from seeding, I'm just curious, you know, I know what it means to, you know, plant seeds in a garden and things like that. With this this lake species, what are you actually doing when you're seeding it? I'm trying to get a mental picture here.
So the process that we have been utilizing is we harvest some seed from ripe plants, and we then are putting it back into these areas that we're trying to revitalize. And we do that in a couple of different ways. One of the ways is a broadcast method whereby we toss the rice and return it back into the water in that way. Mm-hmm. Another methodology that we're using is a traditional methodology that some of our elders have shared with us, and we've collaborated with elders from other tribal communities as well. And we utilize a mixture of clay and sediment from that area combined with the rice, and then we return those seeds to the water and the sediment in that method. And so we're really trying to bring together both the Western science and the traditional ways of doing things so that we're able to end up with a really robust wild rice area.
We're talking about a project to restore wild rice in Lake Winnebago with Jesse Conaway and Jessica Skisuk, two leads on that project. Now, Jesse, you mentioned earlier applying for that restoration funding. You'd gotten some federal funding. Well, a lot of federal funding dried up or was halted. Your project included funding from the EPA. What happened? What was that sequence of events?
So for phase two, which began last fall, in fall of 2024, we were awarded a community change grant from the Environmental Protection Agency. We were awarded $3.3 million. That grant came through University of Wisconsin, and the award was divided evenly between UW-Madison and Brothertown Indian Nation. And so we worked with a project officer in the Environmental Justice Department of EPA for many months, preparing for the award, doing all the trainings, doing all of attending all the webinars, meeting the whole research team, going through all the data collection plans. It was a very rigorous process that we walked through with EPA to prepare ourselves to receive this award as UW-Madison and Brothertown for phase two of this project. And then we had access to this funding later that month. And then early in 2025, about the middle of February, the funding disappeared in the platform that we use to pull funding for reimbursement for achieving milestones on our project as we launched formally into phase two. So that funding was immediately interrupted, and we had a couple months where we were unsure. We were hearing rumors. We were hearing some information that various attorneys were gathering from the Office of Legal Affairs at UW-Madison and also the Environmental Protection Network. Then fast forward to May 1st, 2025, we received the termination letter from the Environmental Protection Agency indicating that the grant had been terminated.
Jessica, what does the block, the cancellation of that funding mean for the project?
In many ways, it is a very significant and devastating has devastating impact on our project. Our heart is here, right? And we have work to do, and we know that we have work to do, and we have strong partners that we're collaborating with. The loss of funding really is interrupting some important cycles for us. The teachings that we have received is with the looking after the sediment and the rice and the water in those conditions and the reseeding, we are instructed by those that have been doing this for an extended period of time, we need to monitor the health of that rice over a longer period of time. And so we were really looking forward to being able to use those funds to have people hired on staff to be able to help with that continued monitoring, the observations, the collection of the water samples and sediment samples, and the analysis that goes along with that from the Western science way, because we're depending on that equally with our traditional knowledge. And so not being able to have those staff continue in those roles and have those responsibilities absolutely impacts our project and what we have going forward for us. We know that our care and compassion for the winged relatives, right? We're not the only ones that care about them. Duck hunters care about them as well, right? We know that people that fish care about the quality of water and what's happening. And we know about the interaction between the wild rice and the fish and how they need one another to continue to sustain themselves for the future. Being able to have those funds to further support the weaving together and the sharing of knowledge across each of these communities of interest around the watershed, that's an important goal for us. And it's absolutely been interrupted with the loss of the community change grant funds that we were selected to receive through the EPA.
I want to end by asking each of you briefly to tell us your hopes for the future of Lake Winnebago, what this could look like if this project is successful. Jessica, let's start with you this time.
My great hope is that we will continue to have improved collaborative relationships where each of us continues to make changes in our daily lives so that the quality of the water and the quality of the sediment is improved, because that directly impacts the wild rice. And that is an important, that's really important for us. The quality of water is essential because in this day and age, we know that water is a scarcity. We have some really high quality water in the area. If we are able to do that in a good way, then the rice will survive and we will be able to take care of our people and our animal relatives that depend on it.
And Jesse, your vision for Lake Winnebago's future?
I would like to see more understanding within the watershed that we're working in, more understanding, awareness, compassion for the ecological benefits of wild rice. I would love to see a heightened community awareness about the intrinsic value of wild rice and of wetlands in general for taking care of our water and our ecosystems that benefit all of us.
Thanks to both of you for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
Thank you so much for having us.
Jesse Conaway is an Indigenous Arts and Sciences Research Coordinator with the Department of Planning and Landscape Architecture at UW-Madison. And Jessica Skisak is Vice Chair of the Brothertown Nation. Find more info about the Wild Rice Revitalization Program. We have a link to their website. You can find that online at WPR.org. That's WPR.org.
Coming up, it's Bat Month. We'll look at efforts to protect Wisconsin's 8 bat species.
Bats are important, right? They're amazing animals and fascinating to us, but they do benefit us, particularly our farmers and foresters, and just us out enjoying our backyard.
That's next here on WPR News.
You're listening to Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about getting up close and a bit personal with bats.
The Natural Resources Foundation of Wisconsin offers hundreds of field trips each year that bring members face-to-face with some of the state's natural wonders. WPR's Beatrice Lawrence went along on a trip to Nelson Dewey State Park along the Mississippi River to witness a swarm of 3,000 bats put on a show as they returned to their homes at dawn.
It's 4 a.m. and dark. Paul White greets about 20 people. He's the bat program lead at the Wisconsin DNR's Bureau of Natural Heritage Conservation.
Must be a lot of birders here. You guys are ready to go.
Yeah. The group finds their seats and waits quietly for the show to start. As the sun slowly rises, we begin to see the bats dancing. This field trip to Nelson Dewey State Park was organized by the Natural Resources Foundation of Wisconsin. It's a nonprofit that works to protect the state's lands, waters, and wildlife. This weekend, the group is camping to see the Stonefield colony of bats as they emerge to feed at sunset. They'll also witness the bats return as a swarm at dawn, all 3,000 of them.
So it's the beauty of morning swarm that we really want to be able to show people, and that's why this field trip is special.
That's Jennifer Riddell, conservation biologist with the Wisconsin DNR. She says she enjoys giving people the opportunity to get up close and personal with an animal that's often misunderstood or unnoticed.
But it's one of the most beautiful and like mysterious wildlife phenomena that happen every morning in the summer, you know, outside every major bat roost across the state, and people don't know about it. And it's this really cool way to experience bats up close
Each year, the Natural Resources Foundation of Wisconsin organizes hundreds of these trips to get people in touch with the natural world and show them conservation projects in action. Riddell says this trip is especially powerful, and that people might even come out the other side as bat lovers.
Because nobody wants to get up at 4 in the morning.
Multiple times.
Right. To watch bats. Until you've seen Swarm, and then you're like addicted. Like, oh, I've got to go see that again.
This expedition is full of field trip veterans, like Henry Nels Lowe of Fitchburg.
They are amazing.
Yeah?
Yeah, they are. All of them are fabulous. You know, I've got a monarch tagging coming up. Hummingbird tagging is coming up. I've just seen so many remarkable things, gone out just learning about different places I've never been.
Against the sunrise, thousands of little brown bats fly around our heads. There's so many, it's a wonder they don't hit each other, or us. The DNR's Paul White prepared us for this moment.
Just close your mouth.
Yeah.
Because you don't want the bat kiss.
Wow.
Yeah.
Last night, the bats left their homes and flew away immediately to eat. But this morning, the bats take their time returning to their boxes. The swarm grows as they dance around each other, occasionally squabbling or flying smack into the side of the boxes. As the bats finally make their way back into their boxes, it falls silent. People like Alex Ellman of Appleton are in awe.
It was amazing.
Yeah.
Like, it was crazy when you started to realize how many bats were underneath the houses swarming. Because, like, there were so many, and it was almost like they would come at you and then split, kind of like the Red Sea, and then circle around. And then all of a sudden, as it got a little bit lighter, I was like, oh, my God, there's, like, so many bats. Like, so many bats. It was so cool.
The bats are finally settled in for the morning.
They're probably wondering where the nearest coffee shop is.
And the humans, we have the whole day ahead of us. Coffee will help, but seeing the bats' morning swarm, no amount of caffeine can energize you like that.
WPR's Beatrice Lawrence brought us that story on bat viewing. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is WPR News.
It's October, which means it is the season of pumpkins and candy, cobwebs, and bats. International Bat Week is later this month, ending on Halloween, and the State Department of Natural Resources has events planned statewide to celebrate.
Wisconsin is home to 8 species of bats. 4 of those are considered threatened species. That decline is mostly due to white nose syndrome, a fungal infection that's decimated populations of hibernating bats.
But last year, some populations in Wisconsin began to show signs of recovery.
2 conservation biologists with the Wisconsin Bat Program join us now for an update on Wisconsin's bat population and conservation efforts. J. Paul White is the Bat Program lead at the Wisconsin DNR's Bureau of Natural Heritage Conservation, and Jennifer Riddell is a conservation biologist and cave and mine specialist with the state DNR. Jennifer, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks for having me.
And Paul, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Paul, let's start with you. October kicks off. What are our bats in Wisconsin doing at this time of year?
Sure. They're migrating either to hibernation sites or they're migrating out of the state entirely. And in many cases, you can find them all along the way. In fact, I stopped by the building here and found one right on the roosting above the doorway.
And Jennifer, we've got multiple bat species. And you were with us about a year ago to talk about white nose syndrome, which people may have heard about. Is this a threat to all bat species in Wisconsin, or those cave dwellers in particular?
No, it's a disease of hibernating bats, and that's because the fungus that causes this disease is a cold-loving fungus, so it only grows in the cool conditions underground on a bat's body that's cold when it's hibernating.
Now, when we last talked to you, this has been, it seemed like nothing but bad news about white nose. There were maybe some positive signs for at least one species. What have we seen over the last year?
Well, over the last several years, actually, we've been getting some good news in Wisconsin, and it looks like our bats may be on a path to recovery. Maybe I wouldn't say a road to recovery, mm-hmm. but our little brown
path.
Right. Our little brown bats and big brown bats have been doing quite well. Big brown's mostly unaffected, and little brown's, the numbers have been going up.
Now, I want to zoom in on little brown bats. I'm kind of familiar with bats. I've talked about them on the show over the years. I didn't realize what a big deal Wisconsin is for. I think it's the little brown bats. They're really concentrated here, right, Jennifer?
Yeah, we have a significant proportion of the little brown bats in the United States hibernating each winter in Wisconsin at just a very few sites, and those are mines.
Paul, some changes have come along in DNR rules about wind turbines. People may have heard about birds and bats having trouble. What kind of changes have there been, and how might they affect our bat population?
Sure. The broad incidental take permit is for wind energy, and the idea is that we recognize that wind is an important energy resource, but we also realize that unfortunately, turbines can detrimentally affect bats. And so we had put conservation measures in place primarily along or in these areas that bats congregate, whether it's a hibernation site in the winter or a summer maternity colony where they aggregate. And so in those areas, we have specific regulations where they actually have to abide by. There's certain cut-in speeds where the wind turbine will start to spin, and we increase those depending on how far they are away from these particular bat priority areas.
And Paul, wind turbines, just one part of the problem, white nose, as Jennifer was saying. Are there other things when it comes to habitat loss or climate change, other things that we are worried about when it comes to their impact on bats in the state?
Both of those, yeah. Yep, habitat loss, climate change, certainly as bats might move, you know, northern in climates. And so we also see that, you know, bats can be evicted during the wrong time of year, and so bats will often find their way into attics, barns, and that type of thing. And if people do not exclude them or evict them during the right times of the year, they can leave vulnerable pups inside and unfortunately separate them from their mothers.
Well, I was going to get into that later. I want to talk to you about I've had that house with bats in it a couple houses ago. And there's always the question, how do I deal with them humanely in a way that, you know, this is a threatened species that doesn't harm them? What do you tell people, Jennifer, who are in that situation?
Yeah, well, no one should have to share their actual living space with bats, right? We do have to be concerned about rabies, mm-hmm. which is in very few bats, but it's a very serious concern.
Yeah.
So to humanely evict bats, we want people to put up one-way doors between August 15th and June 1st of the following year. And that's the period when bats are not using the roost and they're away from that site. And then similarly, if you do find a bat in the living space, if it's just flying around and you've encountered it, you can open a door or window, leave the lights on. You know, we don't want to see that bat get lost under a painting or a couch or something, but it will eventually tire and land if it doesn't fly out on its own. And then you can put a shoebox or a bucket over the top and slide some cardboard underneath and get it put safely outside.
I got to be pretty good at that and wear your gloves too, right?
Correct.
And that critical period though, Paul, the bat breeding period, that month that or so that is excluded, why is that so important?
Well, so June 1st is effectively what we call bat birthday. And so that's when many of the pups are born in Wisconsin. And so at that point, they're very reliant on their mother. 3 to 4 weeks, they cannot fly, and so they're heavily reliant on their mother. They cannot fly. And so as the mothers are leaving, these pups are staying put, and they're using their big feet to stay in one place and hold on for dear life until their mothers come back. And so if you evict during that June and July period, you run the risk of allowing the mothers to leave and not come back in. And so that's where it separates, and you'll eventually, unfortunately, you know, you might end up killing half the colony.
Now, Jennifer, tell us about the role of volunteers in as monitors for the well-being of our bat species, especially those cave bat species.
Yeah, we really rely on the data that volunteers collect and submit because Paul and our colleague Heather and myself can't be out across Wisconsin every night at every bat roost. So there are volunteers who count bats as they drop and fly away from the roost at night. So whether that's a bat house or an attic or a barn, they submit the data, or they're out using a bat. We called a detector to record echolocation calls, and each echolocation call is unique to each species. And then we can take all that data in and look at what's happening statewide and kind of keep our finger on the pulse of bat health.
Something I'm curious about, Jennifer, bats are often in old mines. And actually, I was looking at a presentation you did a while back, and you mentioned, well, they must have been somewhere before humans started building mines. What were bats doing before they had these abandoned human-created mines for their hibernation space?
Right. It's kind of a big mystery. And,
really?
You know, yeah, we certainly have a number of caves, but our caves are small. They typically have one entrance, and they're relatively warm compared to the mines that are usually more spacious and complex. And, of course, they're relics of industry, and they were places where people needed to be safe, so there's multiple entrances. And that means today more airflow and perhaps a wider variety of temperatures for bats. So it seems that once mines were opened up on the landscape and then, of course, later shut down and abandoned, even though people never intended these to be great bat sites, bats are amazingly adaptable at utilizing our human structures, whether it's, you know, the bat in the attic or the bat in the mine. And they've come in and probably survived in greater numbers because of those good hibernating conditions.
Paul, I know people have put bat boxes up, at least for some species. What kind of difference does that make for bats and their well-being?
It can help tremendously, primarily for little browns and big brown bats. It allows them to keep warm in a safe environment away from predators and the elements, and it allows them to raise their pups so that they can go out and eat a bunch of insects. So yeah, it's a great way, and it's actually a really easy way for us to then monitor them. And if we have some sort of treatment that we're looking for white nose syndrome, we can look at those areas because that's exactly, you know, they're concentrated in these areas. So
as we head through the fall and then into the winter, Jennifer, what are the big questions for you as you're watching our bat populations, especially those hibernators?
Yeah, well, we're always curious to see what we're going to find. We go out and survey approximately 50 hibernation sites each year. Again, most are concentrated, you know, in the old mining areas and also the Driftless area where we have natural caves. So the southwest corner of the state. But also
along, lead mining area, places like that.
Right, and also along the Niagara Escarpment and up into Door County, as well as Pierce County, where we have former frac sand mines. And we're always anxious when we go in to, you know, see, has the population continued to grow these last few years? And that makes us feel pretty hopeful when it has. But I have to say that not every species has been impacted the same way. The news is very mixed, so when we go into most of the small sites, the caves and smaller mines, we're not seeing stabilization or recovery in many of those sites. They are still missing most of their bats.
Paul, what do you wish people knew more about bats?
Well, I mean, they're mysterious, they're gentle, we need them, and they need us. And so besides the fact that they eat so many different agricultural pests, forestry pests, and human pests, it's just amazing to be able to marvel at them at night more than ever.
International Bat Week is coming up. What do bat people do to celebrate, Jennifer?
Well, it's a time to celebrate the importance of bats in the environment. You know, people are so fascinated by them. We want folks to go out and learn about them. And there are events happening all across the state of Wisconsin throughout the month of October. We turn it into Bat Month, not just Bat Week, even though Bat Week is at the end of October. So if you visit batweek.org, you can find events near you. And when you learn something, hopefully it's going to be how to help bats. And then we hope you'll be inspired to go out and do that.
And we'll leave it there. Paul, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Jennifer, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
J. Paul White is Bat Program Lead at the Wisconsin DNR's Bureau of Natural Heritage Conservation. Jennifer Riddell is a conservation biologist and cave and mine specialist with the DNR. They join us for an update on Wisconsin's bat population and conservation efforts. By the way, we've got a video up on our Instagram and YouTube feeds with some visual aids from Jennifer and Paul and a bat that made a stopover on the outside of Vilas Hall, where we host this show from.
Earlier this week, we heard a bunch of new country songs released just in time for the Brewers' playoff run. And on the eve of the playoffs, we want to hear from you. Do you have a favorite song that's linked to a Wisconsin team?
Could be an original song written as a tribute to a team, Brewer Fever or Go You Packers Go. Could be a fight song on Wisconsin and such. Or it could be a song that didn't have anything to do with the team at first. Bang on the Drum All Day or Jump Around, for example.
What song gets you pumped up for your team? Let us know. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org or call or text us at 888-642-0232. Once again, that's 888-642-0232. Are you feeling pumped up, Rob?
Pack it up, pack it in, and we can share your comments on a future show.
Wisconsin Today producers include Mackenzie Crummy, Trevor Hook, and Beatrice Lawrence.
Our technical directors are Lee Rayburn and Sarah Hopeful. Tim Peterson is our managing producer. Dean Kinetter is our executive producer.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Thanks for listening to WPR News.